A podcast of the cinema.
Good afternoon to you, Alonzo Duralde, my husband, film critic, editor of film reviews at therap.com, co-host of Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network.
Yes.
Breakfast all day.
Mm-hmm.
How many times a week are you on Deck the Hallmark now?
Once. I'm on Mondays.
Once a week?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And this is the last week of A Film and a Movie.
Film and a Movie, and they got, I don't know how y'all managed, how y'all pulled this off, but you got y'all got Edgar Wright to be on your show.
Yeah.
Talking amazing. About the Sparks Brothers documentary,
which I'll be reviewing next time.
I'll be watching this week, yeah.
Amazing what you can get when you ask for things sometimes. It's crazy.
Sure. It's such a pain to ask for things, though. And, people will say no, and they laugh at you, and they tell you you're dumb.
You are clearly Dave White, film critic for The Wrap.
I prefer just to not bother.
My husband.
Vogue sent me an email just now.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. They care about the things I care about.
Uh-huh.
You know what the main story is on Vogue.com today?
Please tell me.
Jerry Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Remember her?
Still alive?
Yes.
Okay. Wasn't sure.
Has ditched her signature blonde and is embracing the hair color of the moment.
Which is?
Hang on. I'm scrolling down. The hair color of the moment is bold copper, punctuated by a single face-framing bleached streak that recalls the chunky highlights of 90s Jerry Halliwell. And I knew that would be exciting to you.
Because of Jerry Halliwell.
Because of Jerry Halliwell.
Okay. So it seems like that's a very specific hairdo to be the color of the moment.
That's the color of the moment.
Like, I'm just trying to imagine, like, armies of women walking out of, you know, Bonwit Teller or wherever it is that women go.
Bonwit Teller,
you know.
Is that place still
around? I don't
even
think it's still a thing. No, that's an old school department store.
That's a Katharine Hepburn and desk set.
Yes.
kind of store.
Walking out of Barney's New York, where there still are Barney's.
I don't think they exist anymore
really?
Either. I don't know. Oh. I haven't been inside a store in a year and a half. I don't know what stores are even open or closed or anything anymore.
Bergdorf Goodman. I don't know. Anyway, I find
that's
it hard.
That's where Jerry Hall goes.
I find it difficult to imagine like dozens of chic fashionistas all sporting that exact bold copper with a singular gray streak.
You're marching into Tony and Guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, I'd like the color of the moment, please.
Give me the B23,
the
please.
Bold copper punctuated by a single face framing bleached streak that recalls the chunky highlights of 90s Jerry Halliwell, please.
That we're recalling chunky highlights seems like we're asking for trouble.
But look, okay, I'm going to show you. Look how good Jerry Hall looks right now.
Yeah, because Jerry Hall, like, you could put a...
She looks cool with that hair.
A sack of potatoes on her, and she would make it look chic and the new thing.
That's true. Yesterday, a friend of mine and yours, we went to an art gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And, when it was done, he said, I want to have dinner at someplace chic. I said, I don't understand. Where would that be? What?
Is Koi still a thing?
We drove through McDonald's and got pink lemonade slushies, and he got a McFlurry.
Okay, the pink lemonade slushie is tray chic.
I figured it would be.
Yeah.
It's the drink of the summer.
It is. It recalls the chunky highlights of 1990s Jerry Halliwell.
You know what it also does?
Yeah, it hurts
it
you.
It gives me an esophagus freeze.
Well, you should maybe...
Going down.
Check your roll there.
I'm not
slow
having...
Down.
Listen, that's the end of me and my relationship with the pink lemonade slushie.
Oh. You can only be hurt once.
It hurt. It really did actually hurt. Mm. And I thought, am I going to die? Sitting at the traffic stop. Am I going to die sitting at a red light at La Brea and Sunset, or La Brea and Santa Monica right now because of a pink lemonade slushie?
He died the way he lived, consuming garbage.
You take that back.
Sorry, he died the way he lived, enjoying the snack of the moment.
I was having the snack of the moment. Who's the one who's been like, turning you into a vegetarian for the past year and a half.
Yes, yes.
Teaching you the pleasures of eggplant roasted in the oven and other vegetable treats.
Yeah, I know, it's true.
That's me. The name is Dave White.
Yes, you're never turning me into a vegetarian, but I am turning into somebody who eats vegetables a lot more often.
6 days a week, you've been a vegetarian for over a year and a half.
Yeah, but
now,
if you're thinking about meat while you're dutifully eating vegetables, does that count as being a vegetarian?
I will also remind you that every time I put a vegetarian dinner in front of you in the year 2020,
yes,
and early 2021, you said, oh, como te ha salido?
I'm not saying
it's
they
so
weren't,
delicious.
I'm not saying they weren't delicious. I was enjoying
them. Well, then you weren't thinking
thoroughly.
About meat, were you?
I was
no.
Thinking, I was still
you
kind of
were
thinking
not.
About meat. Does it make your cooking any less scrumptious?
You and
than
I need
is?
To have a conversation off the mic about this.
You know.
What do
I'm
I
always,
know?
You know that I'm always thinking about meat when I'm eating something.
Even when it's something incredibly delicious that does not contain meat that I have prepared lovingly for you and that you are flabbergasted by the deliciousness of it.
I am thinking about it in the context of it not being meat. It, as in, this is delicious. I really love this dish that is not meat. Meat is still the default, Dave. That's the only reason. That's why I'm thinking about it. I was always honest with you when I told you how delicious they were.
You're in
they
trouble.
They are.
You are actually in trouble. You are for real in trouble. Remember this moment.
Okay.
Later when I'm yelling at you.
I think I'm sweet.
We went from, I used to think that myself about you. Don't know what I think now. We can hash this out on Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Fine.
Yeah. Mm. All right. This is a podcast of the cinema.
Yes, it is.
We've got films to review.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just get right into the big one?
Sure.
In the Heights.
In the Heights.
Directed by John M. Chu.
Yes.
Based on the Tony Award winning stage musical.
Yes.
From Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Mm-hmm. Which, if you wanted to see it on an IMAX screen, apparently you were already out of luck because...
Oh, yeah?
They've all been taken up by the hitman's wife's bodyguard.
No.
Yes.
Really?
That's
I mean,
what
it
I'm
is.
Told.
It is Wednesday.
Yes. In fact, I was gonna. I just,
we are 3 days late with this podcast.
It just occurred to me because it's Wednesday. Do you want me at some point to review Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, or do you want to save that for the next one? Because it did open today.
I didn't see this film. I'm not gonna
You're
see this film.
You're never going to see this film.
You can save it for next time. No one gives a damn about this
Fine.
Movie.
You can go read my review of The Wrap if you're really dying to know.
I saw the first one.
I saw the first one
what
and
year
had...
What year did the first one come out?
I think 2017.
Well, in the year of 2017, it was one of the handful of films that we would rightfully call the barf of puke.
Yeah, that's yeah. fair. I literally had to go back, find my review, and read it to remember what the heck that movie even was.
I didn't like it, and I didn't remember it. Huh. There you go. But In the Heights... We both liked.
Yes. And I hope that you get to see it projected at some point.
I would like to do that.
I know folks are watching it on the HBO Max, and for any number of reasons, if that's how you got to see it, then that's great.
And you and I screened it via a publicity link.
Yes.
From whatever studio put this
Warner
out.
Brothers. Warner Brothers. But I also saw it on the Warner lot.
You saw it on the screen first.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the big musical numbers in it were exciting even on the TV.
Mm.
I would like to see them on a big screen.
Sure.
Yeah. Anthony Ramos, Corey Hawkins, Melissa Barrera, Leslie Grace, Olga Meredith, Jimmy Smits, Daphne Rubin Vega, so many other people in this film about Washington Heights, New York, the tippy top of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And it's set over the course of a summer. Intersectional lives of everybody in the neighborhood.
Intertwining.
Well, they intertwine, they intersect.
Sure.
Yeah. Intersectional is not just a social justice word.
Okay,
you know?
Fine.
Okay.
Well, I just want to make sure we were being precision of language.
Dave. Yes. One guy wants to go home to the Dominican Republic.
Right.
He runs the bodega. Did we see a cat?
Might be a catless bodega.
I follow an account on Instagram called Bodega Cats.
Right, no, Bodega Cats
and
are legendary.
I was waiting for a cat to show up, and no cat showed up.
You know what?
There's
400 dancers in this movie to also have to deal with a cat.
That cat should have also been a singing and dancing cat.
Uh-huh.
Then this would have kicked this movie up a whole lot.
I believe the movies have made it very clear that cats don't dance.
Well, anyway, he's in love with one of the young women in the neighborhood. She maybe kind of sort of likes him back, but he's too much of a baby.
Yeah,
to say it out loud to her.
She works at the beauty parlor, and the beauty parlor is in the process of moving to Queens because they can't afford the rent anymore.
She wants to move downtown to be a fashion designer.
Right.
There's the guy who works at the local taxi dispatch run by Jimmy Smits. That's Corey Hawkins. His girlfriend, Nina.
Smits's daughter.
Has come home from college. Mm-hmm. First person in the neighborhood to go to college. And
go to college out west, anyway. She goes to Stanford.
Right. It seems like everybody's sort of making a big deal about how she's the first person to go to college from the neighborhood.
Maybe.
Did someone else say, no, I went to college too, dummies. I'm right here. I don't remember that part.
I went to SUNY Purchase, you guys. How come nobody remembers that?
Yeah. I mean, listen, when you're talking all fancy about, yeah, I did go to Vanderbilt and all.
Oh yeah, I'm always doing that.
Yeah, when you're showing off, I always meekly and quietly in the corner said, I too went to university. Texas Tech in 1984, when that was the school you went to when you were A, poor, or B, too dumb to go to any other school because all you wanted to do was party.
You could be A and B.
You could be both.
Yes.
Yeah. But there were a lot of people. There were a lot of people at Texas Tech at that time who were not poor, but who were rock stupid and only cared about partying.
And when you really want to party, you go to Lubbock, Texas.
You kind of do.
Okay.
There's nothing else to do there.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Except binge drink.
And make poor choices. We kid, Lubbock, if you're listening. We love
no, actually, I don't kid. Yeah. I mean, it may have changed since the 80s, but in the 80s, it was...
Okay.
If you went to summer school, if you went to the summer session,
uh-huh.
You could lie down in the middle of the road and not be hit by a car. Like, that's how dusty and quiet it was.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Anyway, There is a lot of singing and dancing in the Heights. In fact, you, unlike La La Land, which is from a couple of years ago, where they front load you with a whole bunch of music and singing and dancing, and then you go for like this 45-minute ride of people just being upset with each other and not singing and dancing. The music never stops in this movie. It keeps moving. The only movie I've seen where there seem to be more songs than this one is The Apple, which never lasts more than 30 seconds without someone jumping into a new song.
And it's not like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, where like every single line of dialogue is sung either.
But you go in here for a musical, you're getting a musical.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And you were talking about how you felt like the second half...
I think
kind of sagged a little
bit. There's a dip in the middle for me. Like the first hour, 15 minutes, I was just like, it's like, bam, one amazing number after another one, and excitement. And I was having that just sort of like flutter of like, this is so great, you know?
Right.
And then there's a point after like there's a character known as Abuela. She's not actually anyone's grandmother, but she's
Abuela
sort of,
Claudia.
She sort of takes care of a lot of the kids in the neighborhood. And
Olga Meredith, who is on the way to getting that Jennifer Hudson
Oscar
Best Supporting Academy Award because of this one giant number.
There had better at least be a full-throated campaign for her. On
if there's not,
of,
I'll be really Warner Brothers. Surprised if there's not.
But like after that big number, for me it kind of like, okay, now we have to iron out some plot mechanics.
Well, yeah, you do have to iron out some plot mechanics.
And then it would still... pick up.
It's a musical. You got to engineer the happy ending.
No, I know. And all then right. like there's a big number about two-thirds of the way through that's pretty great where they're all in the alley and complaining about being hot but still dancing, and everybody.
I did think about that.
Yes, the various flags of the countries that people are from come out and they sort of talk about what a melange of the Latin world lives in Washington Heights, and then the ending is pretty spectacular. But there was definitely a moment where, like, it was the roller coaster was just up, 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 and it was inevitable that I had to have a little bit of a brrr until I got, into it again.
I didn't. That was not my experience, and I watched it on a television set.
Even with that dip, I think this is an extraordinary movie, a lot of fun. It's directed by John M. Chu, who, gets it and knows how to do these kind of dance numbers and getting to work on a much bigger canvas than usual. There are some, he just did a night on TCM where he like showed all these old musicals that had inspired him. And, there's a scene where like, oh, well, you've seen Royal Wedding. Oh, you've seen some Esther Williams movies. And I love that you have. And I love that you're translating that energy into this,
One of the things I really appreciated about this is those references to the past. This is a big, huge, really sweet, corny movie.
Yeah.
That bears not just for the fact that they're singing and dancing constantly, seems to probably, bear no relationship to reality. It is a very well-scrubbed, brightly colored, shiny-surfaced New York City. This is an...
As summers in New York go, this is no Do the Right Thing.
This is an idealized world.
Yeah.
And if you think back to a lot of the old, like, MGM musicals, they are also set in idealized worlds where, sure there might be problems, but everything else seems to run really smoothly and people are willing and ready and eager to forget about their troubles and get happy for a moment and dance in a pool in a synchronized way.
Right. This is the show that they're making fun of in the 40-year-old version.
It's an aesthetic choice that, won't sit well, I think, with people who want their reality to feel real. But there is a high polish, happening here. And at the beginning of the pandemic, when everyone was watching Contagion, I was like, could we maybe sit down with TCM and watch any ridiculous old musical?
Right.
Please. Every single day for weeks, I did that. Because I wanted to enter another world. It didn't matter what world it was.
Sure.
I watched Coney Island, okay?
Benny Grable.
And little did I know, going into that one, how crazy racist it is.
Well,
but then, you know.
It was the 40s.
It was the 40s in Hollywood. And there's a number in the third act that made me feel all the goosebumps stuff. And it's not the Abuela Claudia number. No. It's this other one. It's a love duet.
Yeah.
That I won't spoil it. If you haven't, I don't know if it's in the trailer. I haven't watched the trailer really for this. If I have, I don't remember watching it. But there's, you know, visual stuff that takes place in this love duet near the end that is like, ah.
Oh.
You go, oh, that's why they're in front of a green screen. Okay.
We have not mentioned Lin-Manuel Miranda yet.
He has a small role.
He does, but yeah. He wrote this thing.
He does.
He wrote the music. And the if you have seen Hamilton, which odds are
lots
at this
of
point,
folks have
you
at
have,
this point. Yep.
You will recognize the patter of his Broadway version of hip hop, the rhythm of the.
you sound so ridiculous doing well, that. The he has his own way of taking musical theater form.
Yes.
And, you know,
marrying it.
Is it a marriage or is it?
Smooshing it.
Yeah.
With.
It is the best version of this that I think we can ask for.
Sure.
Because this goes all the way back to Rent, right?
Or Jesus Christ Superstar.
Jesus Christ Superstar is its own thing, and Jesus Christ Superstar actually feels more rock than something like Rent.
Right, but even before the hip-hop musicals, you complained about rock in rock musicals.
That's what I was about to say.
Okay.
Going all the way back to Rent, there was this moment when Rent was huge in the 90s where people were like, yeah, they brought rock and roll to Broadway. And I was like, well, I mean, kind of, I guess. And I think he is a far more successful, you know, mixer-upper
okay.
than
Jonathan Larson.
Than, yeah. Even the Green Day musical felt kind of goofy.
Yeah. Hedwig?
Hedwig was good. Hedwig worked, you
yes.
know. I think there is going to be, you know, there will be people who are hip-hop purists
mm-hmm.
who do not want the, you know, the added element of musical theater form involved in hip-hop. And so those folks probably also did not like Hamilton for sure. that reason.
It will be curious as the audience ages.
Yes.
You and I are in our 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I think once we're in our 60s and 70s,
yeah.
then it will be a clean slate in terms of the Broadway audience will be people who had hip-hop in their lives all along. And at that point, I wonder if that will open the door to people creating a stage version of it that hews closer to classic hip hop than this sort of like in between state we're in now.
I think Lin-Manuel Miranda could be that person. However, he is such a high school drama kid.
Well, sure.
There is everything people complained about regarding Anne Hathaway about 10 years ago. That's Lin-Manuel Miranda. He is He is such a musical theater kid.
Mm, yes, yes.
And you cannot wipe it off his face because he's always got that, here I am.
Gotta dance.
I'm here for the show, you guys. Like, he's always got that very earnest, very eager, very excited demeanor. And
he owns the I can't, I have rehearsal t-shirt.
Yes. So I'm glad he's doing what he's doing.
Yes.
Because with this show, which came before Hamilton,
right,
in the theater world, and then Hamilton, what he has demonstrated handily is that Broadway is ready for, you know, steps into hip-hop on the stage. And audiences who might not know anything about hip-hop are ready to go there with him.
We're within a decade from the Biggie jukebox musical, I think.
Oh, I expect it.
Yes.
I genuinely expect it. So, cool, great, good. But I've already talked to one friend who loves hip-hop and is pretty hardcore about it and was like, no. And I'm like, okay, I get it. I'm not telling you it's going to appeal to you. But,
and not all of the songs here are even flirting with hip hop. Like, correct, a lot of them are just straight up musical theater.
Yeah.
You know, there might be some, you know, there's some Latin, you know, percussion or you know, salsa rhythms thrown in or something. There's like a big salsa dance number that's really spectacular.
Yeah.
He is a theater kid. And actually, did you know that he is about to make his directorial debut,
no,
Mr. Miranda, doing the screen version of an earlier Jonathan Larson musical called Tick, Tick, Boom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Anyway.
I rely on you to tell me what's coming along.
I'm happy to do that. Yeah, so In the Heights is a lot of fun.
There is a current
controversy.
Is it a controversy? I know it was
brought up and it was admitted to, I think. So maybe not a controversy.
There is a discussion happening on the internet right now about colorism in the film. I don't know if that discussion was happening when the show was on Broadway, but it's happening now because of the film. I don't feel I have a place to talk about it. I mean, I'm just a middle-aged white person, and it is an element of the culture that I can see happening, you know, when it's happening. I have over the past, you know, 20 years as a critic, I have watched so many films by directors of color with casts that are entirely populated by people of color, where I'm noticing that, you know, villains are dark-skinned people. Yeah. Like, and that has always sort of blown my mind, because I think, wait a second, you know, you're running this show, and I don't know why.
Monica Castillo has a really good piece about this on NPR.org right now that I would send people to, because and she really goes into the history. She talks about, like, Merle Oberon, you know, like hiding the fact that she was of mixed race and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is nothing new, and it's nothing that's going to be solved anytime soon, but it's a discussion that's happening for sure.
Yeah. Other than that, this movie made me really happy.
Yeah. If you are at a place, you know, where you live and how you live, where going to a movie theater is an option, this is one you might think about doing that for.
And while we're still on the subject of race, there's like 5 white people in the movie. And none of them are consequential, and all of them are sort of jerks.
Yeah, there's like, realtor?
And as I watched it, I was like, well, you know, the fact it's true, white people are the villains of history, so...
There's a terrible dry cleaner.
So it's a terrible dry cleaner. So seeing that in the film, I was like, yep. I've met that person.
Yeah. You are all literal colonizers in this movie.
So moving along, go see this on a big screen.
Yeah.
I know you could probably watch it on, what, HBO Max?
HBO Max.
Don't watch it on HBO Max. Go buy a ticket. Go to a movie theater.
Unless you can't. And if you can't, watch it on HBO
Max. If you don't have the vaccine, don't go. Yeah. But, you know, if you do, Why not? Yeah. All right. Holler.
No, don't do it. No, sorry. Wasn't gonna. This is an indie that opened this weekend as well. And it is a first film from a filmmaker named Nicole Riegel. She wrote, she directed, and it is set in the Rust Belt in a very depressed town. There's one factory left, and by the end of the movie, even it has been shut down. And the action revolves around a young high schooler named Ruth, played by Jessica Barden. She's a British actress. You probably saw her in The End of the Effing World. She's in The Lobster, which I'd have to go back and look and remember who she is.
She's on some episodes of Better Things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting, because Pamela Adlon is...
Right, Pamela Adlon plays her
mom
and mother
in this movie.
In this film.
So Ruth is smart and maybe, you know, headed for bigger and better things. She does not particularly want to leave town. She, you know, even though opportunities are drying up, it's her home, it's where she feels comfortable, but her older brother sends in her college application. She gets in. So now it's a question of, you know, what is she going to do with her life? What decisions is she going to make? She and her brother wind up going to work for this guy who runs a scrap yard. And the real money is in sort of illicit metal. Yeah.
What they do is they go to buildings that have been shut down, factories that have been shut down.
Yeah.
And they strip them.
For copper wire. And
mostly
pipes.
For copper, but for everything else as well. So through it all, she is kind of wrestling with herself about the idea of, you know, do I go to college? What's the point? How do I do it?
Yeah.
Where do I get money from? I can't even get my principal / guidance counselor, whatever his deal is.
Right, to let me check out books from the library.
Help me in any way.
Yeah, he tells her there's a local school where she can learn IT.
A trade, yeah. And, it's IT.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
And also, like, who am I if I'm not a member of, if I don't live here, if I'm not part of this family, part of this community, you know?
So, you've seen this story, variations on it.
Sure.
In American indie filmmaking.
Yeah.
It's different. This is a different take on that story.
How so?
First of all, she is bratty as hell.
I know you admired that about her.
I super admired that about her. Because so often in these films, that character, the kid who's going to get out, is
writing poetry
so
in her journal.
Virtuous, so virtuous as to be irritating.
Yeah.
She is not.
No.
She's a pain. She's got a smart-ass answer for anybody and everybody who crosses her path.
Yeah, she is not having it with her mom, heaven knows.
No. You know, if anything, the virtuous character in the film is her brother, who is doing everything he possibly can.
Yes.
To carry her up the ladder to safety. And she is sort of like, leave me alone, you jerk. You know? And so I found that refreshing, like real family dynamics. The mom, you know, Pamela Adlon, stuck in jail because of drug addiction rather than, you know, an actual place that could help her. What? And they want her to go to a rehab, and she's like, no.
Too far away.
Yeah. Did you mention Becky Ann Baker already?
I did not. I love Becky Ann Baker.
Becky Ann Baker from
Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks and Girls. Yeah. She plays family friend who sort of, you know, looks out for everybody.
Yeah.
And the filmmaking is really controlled. And the things you're worried about happening don't happen. The cliche stuff that you're kind of holding your breath about.
Right.
Those things don't happen.
Sense of place at the yin yang.
Yep. I really admired this very sort of like low-key approach to something that could have gone really south. Like every once in a while you hear TV news reports, you know, about Trump this, Trump that. Mm-hmm. And I think I would like it if we could not put too much on the nose here. And they don't. You only hear about that a couple times in the film. And so what you get is a film that could really take place in any part of the country anytime during the past 40 years, because it has been about 40 years since Republicans came into the White House under Ronald Reagan and systematically destroyed the social safety net and made life for working people next to impossible. It's their fault.
Yes.
And wishy-washy, spineless corporate Democrats.
Who let them do
it? I'm just going to interrupt this review right now for a little bit.
Please do.
To sell y'all on some socialism. I've got it right here in my bag. Would you like to have a look? The 2021 model is very attractive. So anyway, this is what Hillbilly Elegy thought it was going to be. There is no, well, maybe it didn't think it was going to, maybe Ron Howard thought he was making this
perhaps,
movie.
Perhaps, yes.
That piece of ish who wrote the book and who is now a full-on white supremacist.
Not Ron Howard, the guy.
The guy who wrote the book, whatever the hell his name is. This is sort of like what Hillbilly Elegy should have been if it didn't have all the self-congratulatory right-wing bootstraps.
Nonsense.
Crap. Yeah. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
H-O-L-L-E-R. Holler. As in, my kin, we're from the holler.
And yeah, I've been slow to get on the Jessica Barden train, but clearly she's
not as harrowing as Winter's Bone.
Mm. But very wintry.
Well, it is very wintry.
No one is ever warm in this movie.
No, and they really shot it like when the snow is falling and the people are freezing outside. Yeah. Sublet. Would you like me to talk about Sublet?
Why don't you?
All right. It's from Eitan Fox, Israeli filmmaker. Set in Tel Aviv. Stars John Benjamin Hickey. And a first-time actor. Well, first-time film actor.
Right.
He's a stage guy in Tel Aviv. Named Niv Nissim. So over the course of like 5 days, a gay, late middle-aged New York Times travel writer, that's John Benjamin Hickey, he arrives in Tel Aviv. He's doing a piece for the paper. He gets an Airbnb, realizes that the young gay man who lives there doesn't have anywhere to go for the 5 days that he's renting out his apartment. His name is Tomer. So John Benjamin Hickey says, well, I mean, it's your place. You could sleep on the couch if you want to. I mean, I paid for the bed, so.
Right. Yeah. And you can show me the hidden Tel Aviv.
Yeah, he's like, you can show me the places that a local person who lives here would know. You know, not a tourist or a travel writer, because he shows him this whole list of places that he's supposed to go, and the young guy is like, oh, ha-ha.
And the point of the column is that it's off the beaten path,
yes,
non-touristy places.
Yes. So they hang out the whole week, and, you know, they're both gay, so they talk about, you know, love and relationships, and, you know, Hickey is a guy who's got a husband back home, who is sort of kind of behind his back setting up a surrogate for them to have a baby.
I'm like, surprise, honey!
Y'all have some serious communication troubles in your marriage.
Do not spring that on me.
I have something to tell you. I have two things to tell you, in fact. Number one, do you know how much surrogates cost?
Oh, I can guess.
And number two, if we were ever going to have raise a child,
that ship has sailed.
That, first of all, we are too old to start now. And you don't need to go making more genetic materials in the world. Somebody else already made one for you that's waiting for a parent somewhere.
No kidding.
You know?
John Benjamin Hickey's character is older than either of us, and he's thinking...
By a few years, yeah.
He's ready not to be... Too, he's ready to dad it up.
Not too many, but by a few. I'm sorry. A third thing I'd like to tell you. It would touch our stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes. All right. Anyway, back to the movie called Sublet.
Yes.
They learn from each other about life and the perspectives of different generations. The older gay is a bit wise and a little battered around by life.
Yes.
He's a little tired. He has lost a little bit of his joy of living.
Yes.
But the young man is brash and energetic.
Right.
And he thinks love is for suckers and relationships are doomed and blah, 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 blah. And he thinks he knows better.
He too has things to learn.
It turns out, as Whitney Houston once said, it turns out these two men of different ages, 158, 128, they can learn from each other about life, love, friendship, sexy things.
Mm.
The end.
Yeah, this is not the best Iton Fox movie. I like his films quite a bit, generally speaking.
Yeah, I don't want to crap on his earlier films, which I also think, you know.
I got to look. Good. I don't know that it's ever been made available in the U.S., but this is the kind of thing that you go to film festivals for. At Outfest several years ago, we ran like a four-hour miniseries that he did for Israeli TV called Mary Lou, which I loved. But and it was the kind of thing where, like, I saw it when we were programming it, and I kept telling people, no, really, come see this four-hour thing because you will never get to see it again.
Right.
Like, unless you have access to, like, if you have an Israeli DVD rental store in your neighborhood, you are not going to see this thing. But yeah, this is, do we think that he was like, I need a hit in America? Like, I don't know what's going on here, but
I don't know.
He's better than this.
I will tell you the stuff that made me laugh and that I thought was really spot on.
Okay.
when Tomer, the young guy, asks John Benjamin Hickey if he, you know, sees his parents very often, because he's complaining about his mother.
Right.
His mother is very sort of like, come to dinner, please come to dinner. I want you to come to dinner. And he's like, no, Mom, I'm young and I'm running around Tel Aviv being cool and hot and having sex, you know.
Did I mention young?
And John Benjamin Hickey says, no, my parents are dead.
Dummy.
And the kid goes, kid, 28. He's a grown-ass man.
Yeah.
The young man goes, I forgot. I'm not supposed to ask that question to people over 50. Which is accurate.
Yes.
My other favorite moment was the young guy learns that John Benjamin Hickey at one point wrote a novel.
Right.
Came out in the early 90s. And he finds it in a secondhand bookshop and he starts reading it. And he starts complaining. He goes, it's so depressing. I said, why does everything have to be about AIDS? Why do we have to go back in time and, you know, talk about that all the time? And John Benjamin Hickey says, I was there. And I wrote about that in real time, and the book was published at that time. My first boyfriend died of AIDS. The book was written in 1990.
It's not a period piece.
No. And the young guy goes, oh, no. I'm an idiot twice. those two moments in the film feel like they come from real life conversations.
Sure.
You know, our young queer friends who are in their 20s, these are sometimes the conversations that we are having with them.
True.
And so that stuff felt right. And everything else felt like it had already been programmed into a, you know, a grid somewhere. You know, like there was a set outcome in place.
Right.
And we put some authentic real life moments of, you know, generational friction in there, but it's certainly not enough to make the movie feel like it's going somewhere important.
No, I agreed. I think the two actors are fine. I think they're giving it their best shot. I like Hickey as an actor, and it's interesting to see him play a lead, I think, because he's very often like, you know, he's, I think, in the theater had a lot more opportunities, but when you see him in film or TV, he's usually third something, you know.
Right.
So the fact that he's front and center, that's kind of cool. I like this young guy. I think he seems very comfortable on camera. He's got definite, you know, charisma. The camera likes looking at him.
Right.
It's the writing, you know, that they have to contend with, unfortunately. And Fox has done better. I'm sure will do better. This is just kind of a whatever. Dave, can I tell you all about Peter Rabbit 2?
You have 30 seconds.
It's not worth your time.
What a shock. I didn't see the first one either.
Yeah, the first one was had its moments at least. I mean, look, these movies are desperately, desperately trying to be Paddington. And, sir, I've worked with Paddington. I know Paddington. You are no Paddington.
You are no Paddington, right.
You are James Corden, in fact, which is quite the opposite. What this movie does, though, that is singularly
England?
Annoying.
Hey, England. Can you come fetch him?
Come get your boy.
He is bothering the hell out of me. Did y'all send him away?
I think they pranked us. We gave him a Tony and then he wouldn't go away. Anyway, what's annoying about this movie is that the premise, part of the premise, is that the Rose Byrne character, who at the end of the first movie has written the Peter Rabbit book.
Yeah.
So now in this one, a hotshot publisher comes along, played by David Oyelowo, who's one of the best things in the movie, and wants to make them like more hip and edgy and like, you know, oh, the rabbits should all have like t-shirts and high top sneakers and maybe go into space.
Cool.
And it's basically the movie talking about what these movies are doing to the Beatrix Potter stories. They're goofing on the idea of like, oh yeah, we're making them all flashy and, you know, kid friendly and studio friendly and, you know, marketing tie-in friendly and blah, 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 which is what these crap movies are doing. But they think that because they're telling you they're doing it, that's going to make it okay.
Right.
They're trying to be like meta jokey about it. See, we're crapping on Beatrix Potter's, you know, legacy, but we're telling you we're doing it. So, No, thank you, no. There's a few okay set pieces. There's always a few okay set pieces. But overall, you know, if you have children, you're desperately trying to entertain. You can get the Blu-ray later and just pop it in when they come over and are bothering you. But other than that, don't.
Do not take your children to see this movie in the theater because you will be tempted, perhaps, to abandon your children.
If this is what it means to be a parent, I can't.
Hey, guess what?
What?
There's a new old Hong Sang-soo movie.
I know you're so excited about
it. I'm so excited about it. And you watched it with me, and I'm double excited about that.
It is the first of his films I've ever seen.
Well, I have something to tell you. You have some catching up to do.
I know. He cranks those babies out.
This man.
He's the Danielle Steele of Korean cinema.
This man is prolific. Like, every 2 months, he has a new movie in theaters. This is called The Power of Kangwon Province. Mm-hmm. It's from 1998. This is a restoration. It was his second film. You can watch it It's in virtual cinemas right now. It might be in theaters too, but it is currently...
I believe it's exclusively at
Film at Lincoln Center. Okay, well, if you don't live in New York City...
No, online.
Oh, it's only online. All right, it's a streaming virtual cinema. FilmLink, L-I-N-C. FilmLink.org is where you can see it. Anyway, it's about men and women and how they are very bad for each other.
Straight people, we have some very bad news.
Y'all got some problems. There are two overlapping, occasionally intersecting stories.
Yeah.
The first one is three young college women, girlfriends, on a overnight little jaunt up into the mountains. One of them, her name is Jisook, she has been having an affair with a married man. Her friends learn on the trip up that she has dumped him. Which is good, because right on time, here comes another married man, a police officer, that Jisook decides she's going to have a one-night love affair with. But she and the guy
both... Is that a Bryan Adams reference?
So, I don't know. Is that a Bryan Adams song?
Yes.
Was
One Night Love Affair.
I don't know anything about
trying
this.
Trying to play like we don't care.
I do not know this song.
We're both just reaching out
do you
for
know why?
Something.
Do you know why I don't know this song?
Why, Dave?
I don't listen to that man singing.
Well, it's in Real Genius.
Fine. I'm talking about the power of Kangwon Province.
Please continue.
All right. They both get so drunk.
Yeah.
That he has to sort of prop her up to get her back to her room. And they both lie on the bed and they're sort of like, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Like, they're not even, like...
It's real romantic.
If they thought they were going to do, you know, capital I, it,
mm-hmm.
they were both wrong. So, weirdly, though, they stay in touch.
Yeah. She comes back.
Yeah, she comes back. And it goes worse.
They get super drunk again.
They get super drunk again, and this time they're yelling at each other. All right. Shifting here.
We go back to the same train ride the college girls are on.
And what we have now are the married guy Jisook dumped.
Yeah.
And his buddy, the professor. Now, they are both professors.
Right.
We learn. And there's some tenure rivalry between them, but it's unspoken.
Yeah.
You know? And this trip, very much like the trip with the young women, spends a lot of time in a cafe where there is eating and drinking and more drinking and more drinking and more drinking and these sort of drunken confessions and accusations and, you know, friendships tested over the course of a meal. Now, that is a signature of a Hong Sang-soo movie. Mm. People sitting in a restaurant, getting drunk, and saying terrible things to each other.
All right, well, then maybe I've seen all of his films now, because they do that a lot in this one.
And the weird thing about it is that when it's among the three young women, you think, oh, well, you know, they're in college. This is that time in your life when you're young, when you think that experimenting with brutal honesty will be good for you and your friendships. But then you see the two older guys doing exactly the same stuff. Meanwhile, there's a murder taking place.
Yes.
And no one notices anything about what's going down. They all, in their two separate stories, they pass by the people involved in this...
A married couple.
Fatal act. A married couple. The point being that if you get that far...
Yes.
To actual marriage,
If your husband doesn't watch cheat out on you with a college girl,
he might push you off a cliff.
Yes.
Yeah. People are so wrapped up in their own petty business in this film that someone can literally be murdered in their vicinity and they don't notice a thing. And it's not an indictment about these specific people. Hong Sang-soo is often telling you that this is just how the way people are.
Right.
They're petty. They're petty and they're self-involved and they're delusional and they don't do friendships or romantic relationships well. There's a little more intersecting of people. There might be a break in the case.
One of them might be a witness.
Maybe. Ultimately, what the film is about is Hong Sang-soo's observations of human behavior.
Yeah.
His characters, they do a lot of talk, like an Eric Rohmer movie, really. But they seemingly talk not about very much. Like, Rohmer's characters are constantly referencing, you know,
Pascal.
Yeah, philosophy and mathematics and stuff like that. Hong Sang-soo's characters are talking about, are we going to go to the public bath?
Yeah.
You know?
Office politics.
Yeah. But in these little details that they sort of casually throw out at each other,
right,
those everydaynesses that are what fill the running time, you find out who these characters are. You find out how inconsistent they are, how selfish they are, how insecure they are, how insistent they are about having their own way all the time.
Yeah. How selfish they are.
And, you know, watching them, you realize you are probably pretty much the same.
The end.
Did I tell you that this is a very cool movie and really wonderfully made and so skilled at balancing the mundane stuff that they're doing, this banal activity, with ever mounting personal tension and even plot tension. You barely realize it's happening while it's happening. His filmmaking is not showy at all.
No.
He plants that camera and lets people talk.
But it's a slow burn.
But he is moving them in a way that is very, very much intentional.
Yeah.
This isn't people sitting around talking about nothing, the end.
Yeah.
It's not that at all. I'm a fan of this guy. I've seen many of his films at this point. And I'm super glad this got a reissue. It's a wonderful place to start if you've never seen any of his films.
Yeah, having gone in cold, I can say I was like, what's happening here? But in a good way.
So yeah, everyone's an a-hole. And
it's interesting that this guy's making a movie about, like, faithless husbands, given that, like...
Uh-huh. Oh, you know, he's... when Hong Sang-soo points a finger, three are pointing back at him.
So yeah, check this one out.
And what is your DVD pick of the week?
Oh, why don't you go first?
It's Pride Month.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you about a movie that we are going to watch for the Linoleum Knife Club meeting.
Oh, God.
If you're at that Patreon level where you go join us once a month for the LK Club meeting where we watch a movie and we sit around and talk about it on Discord, in a private Discord group, this Saturday night we're going to watch a movie called The Gay Deceivers from 1969. Why are we watching The Gay Deceivers during Pride Month? Well, because it is a homophobic exploitation film.
Never forget.
It is a comedy of sorts about two young jerks who decide that they do not want to get drafted and go to Vietnam, so they pretend to be a gay couple, and they move into an apartment building where they have a gay landlord, and they're all trying to trick the draft board. You would think this would be sort of like a, you know, a sympathetic film about the gays. But no.
No.
It's a sympathetic film about the straight guys enduring the hideousness of having to pretend to be gay.
The poor things.
The poor things. But it is not misery all the way. It is tempered by one really strong element.
Yes.
There's a character actor named Michael Greer who plays the gay landlord. And he was an openly gay actor from the beginning of his career, so much so that it didn't sit well with his, you know, trying to get jobs. Casting people didn't want to hire openly gay actors for stuff that wasn't stereotypical gay characters,
right,
who were meant to be the butt of jokes.
Right.
But Michael Greer, what's the right word? He sashays powerfully,
yes,
through this film in a way that dominates everything, everybody around him.
He dares you to assume that he's not the hero of this film.
Yes. So it's this super crazy mixed bag of a movie where the intention is, let's laugh at the gays.
Yes.
Oh no, we cast a really powerful gay guy in this film who is not having it.
Yeah, who rewrote his own dialogue, apparently.
Yeah.
And basically, like, totally gets what movie he's in, but also grew up on a steady diet of, like, Franklin Pangborn and Edward Everett Horton and Eric Blohr, and just, like, sweeps in and puts this movie in his handbag and just takes off with it. And
like,
you know,
he's here to win it.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Just, like, does that great sort of supporting actor thing where it's like, whoop, movie's about me for a while, and bye!
And he's in it a lot, too.
Yeah.
It's not like he just shows up for a few minutes. He's an integral part of this film. So I have been fascinated with the Gay Deceivers for a long time because exploitation films are history.
Yeah.
They are part of cinema history, and we wouldn't have what we have now in queer cinema without garbage like this and people who struggled to
elevate,
make it less garbage.
And also what's great about old exploitation films is because they're made on the cheap and don't really and do a lot of shooting on location, they're kind of, you know, like anthropological.
Oh, you'll see it again. I've been rewatching it this week in preparation for the club meeting.
Oh.
And
you want to see what LA looked like in 1969.
Do you know where the exteriors were shot?
In our neighborhood?
On suites are like three blocks down the old Charlie Chaplin stables.
Oh, right, right,
now
right.
Condos.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can see it. Like, and I was like, I know that building. I know that building.
Well, that's like
the
terrible partners, you know, the grocery store they go to is now a Petco on Doheny, just south of Santa Monica.
Anyway, this movie is available in a weird, occasionally disjointed version on YouTube, but there's also a DVD,
mm-hmm,
and there is, it is streaming currently on Tubi, T-U-B-I, which is where we will be watching it.
Cool.
Saturday night.
Excellent. Well, mine is also a Gay Pride Month pick, but it is the polar opposite of the Gay Deceivers in that it's really good and made by queer people about queer stuff. And that is a very exciting box set that Criterion is putting out this coming Tuesday called The Signifying Works of Marlon Riggs.
Yes.
I don't have time to go fully into Marlon Riggs here, but basically he is an essential black queer filmmaker from the 1990s.
Yep.
He was one of the artists who really got up Jesse Helms' urethra by having spent National Endowment for the Arts money. On queer material.
Hold my mouth away with the microphone. Fucking LOL IRL.
Most known for an extraordinary film called Tongues Untied, which is just, I think, essential viewing for everybody and very much part of the new queer cinema
movement.
You gotta
warn me before you say stuff like
that. But this box has pretty much everything that he did, including Black is Black Ain't, shorter films like Affirmations and Anthem and Non Je Regrette Rien, Ethnic Notions, which is his first film, his really great documentary for PBS called Color Adjustment, about the history of black characters on primetime television through like the late 80s, narrated by Ruby Dee, also a vital piece of film, the least queer thing he did, but still you know, important. Anyway, I have been waving the banner for Marlon Riggs for decades. He's just so major in queer cinema history, and I'm so glad that Criterion is making all of his stuff available in one handy set. So yeah, this is a Blu-ray that belongs in your queer cinema library, The Signifying Works of Marlon Riggs. We have some letters.
Oh, we do?
Yes.
I forgot about that part.
How could you?
I don't know.
You said you'd never forget.
Yeah. Well, let me pull them up here on my laptop with that thing. Sorry.
It's fine.
All right, here's one from Dino. I've been listening to Linoleum Knife for about 5 years now, and I'm a big fan. The first episode of yours that I came across was one from February of 2016, where you discussed Hail Caesar and some other movies with Drew Droege. I haven't missed an episode since, and I so appreciate how you two will review both big movies, higher-profile independent films, and very obscure low-profile independent films, as well as the occasional classic. In your last episode, you read a letter where the person said a movie should be made of Dodie Smith's The Starlight Barking. This reminds me that I recently watched Darling, How Could You? From 1951, directed by Mitchell Leeson.
Yes.
In which Dodie Smith has a screenplay credit.
Oh,
perhaps you've seen it already.
Not yet.
If you haven't, I would highly recommend this delightful farcical comedy based on a J.M. Barrie play starring Joan Fontaine and John Lund. Fontaine is one of my favorite actors of her era, and I feel she's quite underrated despite having an Oscar. This movie showcases her comedic chops, something she was rarely able to display in her films. I know that Alonzo is a fan of Midnight.
Yes.
This movie feels like a forgotten gem of Leeson's later career, and Criterion was nice enough to put it on their service, along with many of his other films. Yeah, we need to get caught up on those.
Yeah,
other,
we were going to go through that whole set, and then we kind of stopped.
I didn't say we stopped. We got busy.
Yes.
That's what happened.
Yes, yes. Life got in the way.
Dr. Steve.
Anyway, thank you for that tip. We will see.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We will. Dr. Steve asks, what is the best use of fashion as a parachute? Cruella or Barb and Star?
Does it have to be competitive? Can't we just
Why
admire
must we pit
all
women
of them?
Against each other?
Yes. Why can't they support each other
Why
in their journeys?
Why can't everybody fly in clothing?
Yeah.
Dr. Steve, we don't know the answer, because while we're going to go to the mat for Barb and Star until the day we die, I think Cruella is being unfairly maligned.
Oh, yeah.
And for no other reason at all, you need to watch this movie because of the clothes.
Yeah. I think Disney movies right now are flying literally over the heads of straight people. I don't think they got Cruella, and I don't think they're going to get Luca.
You guys, we just watched Luca. Is the embargo lifted?
Yes.
Can we just say something a little bit?
Yeah, we'll be talking about it. We'll talk about it in detail next time.
Y'all, there's a reason it's being released in June.
Yes. And it's not gay in a way that like, oh, I can't show it to my children, but it's real gay.
You know what? If it were about an actual gay child,
yes,
then you should show it to your children.
Of course, but I'm just saying, anybody who that's going to be their excuse, it's like, no, there is nothing.
They're not listening to this show.
Okay, fine. You're right. You're right.
You've set up a person who isn't listening to this show. Those are the letters.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. And please do check out my other podcasts, including especially this last film and a movie, because we had a really great conversation with Edgar Wright. Check out Bibbs and Whitney over at the Critically Acclaimed. Actually, we have two podcasts to plug with Dave White.
So here's what happens.
You're the star this
week. I don't get asked to be on anyone's podcast ever, which honestly...
It's fine by you.
Please don't take this as me being like, oh, I never get invited anywhere. I would prefer not to be invited to most places. Because then I have to say, okay, sure, yeah, I'll go to whatever it is, your birthday party at some bar in Echo Park at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night. Sure, sounds fun. But I got invited to be on two podcasts and weirdly they're not allied with each other at all. And they both asked me to come on and talk about filmmakers that I'm super into. And it happened in the same week. One was a Monday, one was a Thursday of the same week.
And they're both out now.
The first one, is a podcast called Cinepunks. P-U-N-X, and hosted regularly by Josh and Liam. And I like their podcast quite a bit. You should listen to them. And they invited me to come on and talk about two films by Pichatpong Wirasuthukum, Tropical Malady and Cemetery of Splendor. And I was thrilled to get to do that because, you know, I don't get to do that very often. You know, people aren't laying out the red carpet for me to come talk about, you know, Thai filmmakers that I like. Then, suddenly...
Word got out.
Without so much as a kiss my foot or have an apple. B. Peterson and their new podcast, All About Ovid. A podcast that is specifically investigating... all of the content on the Ovid streaming service, which is really a good idea for a show, you know.
For people who think that the Criterion Channel is too bougie.
Co-hosted by everyone's favorite blue-haired bisexual darling, Whitney Seibold.
Yes.
From Critically Acclaimed. They came here to our home.
Yes.
I fed them cake. And we talked about three films from Tsai Ming Lei. The Hole, Goodbye Dragon Inn, and the documentary Afternoon. It was wonderful. I could just like talk and talk and talk about two filmmakers that I really love. So those are the two podcasts that I will be invited on in 2021. So book me for 2022 now while you have time.
Well, I think that we will be doing maybe some Patreon crossover with Bibbs and Whitney sometime soon.
Oh, yeah, that.
But I think on one of them we'll talk about the new Murder Bakery movie.
Is it set at Christmas?
I don't think it's set at Christmas. It's still a Murder Bakery, though.
Bibbs, Whitney, I love you both so much. And every year in July, I want to murder all three of you. You too, husband. All right.
More on that later.
Wrap it up.
As it develops. Anyway, yeah. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the program and for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We will read it on the air. Leave us also positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, Google Play, Amazon Music, you name it. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Check him out at bandcamp.com/BLEU. You can follow us on the social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We thank you for listening, and until next time.
Oh, you know what?
What?
All About Ovid is spelled with all O's. So it's OllObout Ovid. That's there. So don't go Googling it, trying to spell it like it's the right way to spell it.
You told me that a film and a movie was a show that nobody could Google. I think we have a winner. But yes, do go check out Dave on.
Well, you know what?
All About Ovid.
I didn't name this podcast. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
Just everyone should know that you. That's how you find it.
Fine. Yeah. Good to know. Good tip. Until next time.
Goodbye.